Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration. Collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next guest is Martin Himmel. He is a war correspondent, he's a journalist, he's a documentarian and a filmmaker. He is a very interesting guy, and we are talking today about his new film, Secrets of Survival, which is going to be airing on the Documentary Channel in the very near future on CBC. Check it out online. You can find him online, Martin Himmel, martin-himmel.com, and check out the film and the blurb on it and the trailer, Secrets of Survival, on CBC's site. Martin and I, he was calling in, or I was calling him in Tel Aviv, and we had a great line and a real opportunity to talk about a whole lot of things. We talk about family, and we talk about isolation and identity, and we talk about loneliness, and we talk about being included and this sense of the past and coming to terms with, you know, I guess you could say the family secrets that we all have. And so I think you're going to really enjoy the conversation. There's a lot going on here. And how's this for investigative journalism? For a quote, investigative journalism is an obsessive compulsive disorder, says Martin. That's got to draw you in. So stay tuned. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more of my podcasts and my writing and speaking. You can find out about it there. You can also support Face to Face through patreon.com and rabble.ca for more interviews. And coming right up, Martin Himmel talking about his new film, Secrets of Survival. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here today, all the way from Tel Aviv. Martin Himmel is here today. He's a director. He's a producer. He's a correspondent. He's a journalist. Martin, thank you so much. Thanks for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, based on my research I've done of you, Martin, we could talk about a whole lot of things. You've had quite a history, and I'm hoping that you're going to tell us a little bit about that. But we're here to talk particularly about a film, a world premiere coming up on April 9th on the Documentary Channel with CBC here in Canada, called Secrets of Survival. As you just mentioned before we hit record, you don't want to give too much of it away. So we're going to have to be careful here. You're going to have to dial me back a little bit. But what can you tell us about the film?
Well, the film basically focuses on two people who you would call second generation. In one case, a Holocaust second generation survivor. A Toronto woman named Malka Rosenbaum, who at a young adult age discovered from her parents, who did survive the Holocaust, that she was not the only child that she thought she was throughout her life. Being an only child was an experience for her. It was a difficult but also you know, a rewarding experience, but also a difficult experience because she felt somewhat isolated. And then, lo and behold, in her 20s, she's told, well, you weren't an only child. There was once a sister, Esther, and who, according to her parents, had died in the Holocaust. Finding that out was a major plot point in her life. It refocused everything. You know, as she puts it with her mother, well, if you, now you're telling me there was a sister, what more are you not telling me? And that's a very important point. You know, what else is there?
Right.
I mean, in some senses, she feels like she has been deceived, or that they weren't honest with her, that there's many things that are secrets here that she doesn't know. It opened the Pandora box, basically. And what basically, that's the way it was for many, many decades. Until not long ago, doubt came into the fact, how is she sure that this sister is indeed dead? There are scores and scores of people in Poland who were raised as non-Jews, thousands upon thousands of them, and discovered that they were Jews, and that they came from Jewish families. Often when their adopted parents, who also kept secrets, told them on their deathbeds that you had a Jewish family. Mm-hmm. So she had, at that time, Malka had an aunt in Israel who was 95, 96 years old, who basically said, look, your parents were in hiding, although she knew that, but your parents were in hiding during the war, and your mother gave birth, and the baby had to go. Baby has to go because the people that are hiding the Jews, if they were caught, and often it was families that were hiding Jews, everyone in the family would be immediately executed, mother, father, children, etc. No questions asked, immediately taken out and shot along with the Jews. So it's a high-stakes issue to hide someone.
Yeah.
So if a baby is born there, a baby can scream and squeal and give away everybody. So the baby was out within a day, and they thought it went to some woman who could breastfeed somewhere out there in the world. And then the word got back to them at some stage this baby had died, but they had no confirmation. And this Aunt Franya told Malka, well, you know, it is possible that the other child that this woman was breastfeeding might have died, and your sister might have survived. No one knows. And we go on a journey basically to find out if Malka's sister is alive or not and what really happened. And in the course of the film, we answer this completely and clearly, and it does change Malka's life. That's the search on that part of the story. Then we go across, if you want to call it, enemy lines.
Right. That was going to be a question for sure. How intentional was that decision, going across enemy lines?
Actually, it was not intentional. I must tell you, it only came when we were looking with a lot of people to see what story we came to, and we didn't know what story is going to develop. But once it did develop, it is across enemy lines. It was really something ipso facto, not something that I planned out. Much of what happens here is not planning. It's reacting.
Right.
And so there are different people we were searching to see what stories we can get, and then we see certain stories went and certain stories did not, and this story did go, and that story is Jürgen Ulott, who was born in post-war Germany to a German family outside of Frankfurt, and like many German families, his mother was 16 years old, 17 years old, had lost her father, who was a German naval soldier, inducted at 44, who was an accountant, into the war and disappeared. And her grandfather, she came from a well-to-do family in Cologne, had committed suicide after Allied bombing had blown apart the chocolate factory that he had and lost everything. She lived with her mother and her sister in a town that was blasted pretty good as well. And lo and behold, married a German war veteran. And this German war veteran was an interesting story, too, because he came along in 1952, Erich Ulott, and he told Gertrude, Jürgen's mother, that he actually was with Gertrude's father, you know, prisoner of war camp in Russia for many, many years, and that Gertrude's father had actually escaped and disappeared. He was probably killed. And he came back to tell Gertrude and the family what happened to the father, because he spent 6 years in that camp. And in the process, fell in love with her. And Jürgen, for many, many years into his early adulthood, felt that that's how his mother and father met. Eric met Gertrude. Eric was the war vet, and Gertrude, his mother, and that was life. And then they had a brother, and that was life, until he decided to get married. And when he went to get married in Germany, you have to go to the registry office there and produce birth certificates, etc., in Frankfurt. And much to his absolute shock and surprise, the registry clerk said, look, your name is not Jürgen Ulot. Your name is Jürgen Reinhold. It's not Ulot. Reinhold was his mother Gertrude's maiden name, Gertrude Reinhold. And then it became extremely clear that Eric, his father, the German war veteran, was not his father. So this was a completely massive shock for him, a very deep shock.
I couldn't help but think, you know, Martin, as I was watching the stories unfold and so on, you know, would I, and I think this is what a great documentary does and the storytelling and so on, but would I be reacting the same way? Would I be so upset about this? Would I be so concerned?
Would you?
Yeah, I think so. I think I would.
I would.
Yeah, like you, it's kind of like I'm not who I thought I was, right? And I think your comment earlier, and I think it's a really good one, is, you know, if this is the secret you've been holding from me, what else is there that you haven't been telling me along the way? And that's a doozy. As far as, I mean, I think it's Jürgen at one point, he refers to the complexity of, you know, what happened with his mom and with you know, these two men, basically. And I think the quote was, they destroyed big love. And it really kind of, you know, it was a beautiful line. And it really struck me that's kind of, for me, what's at the heart of this story, in a way, you know, it clearly it's about investigative journalism. It's about finding the answers. It's about getting to the truth. But for me, it's about love. It's about memories. It's about family and the past and helping others and how we're also incredibly interconnected. You know, it's just it's astounding, Martin.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, it's looking in hindsight, it is all of that. As you go through the search, it's like one revelation after another.
Right, right, nice.
And with Jürgen, so he marches to his mother, and to his absolute, you know, it's a tremendous sense of betrayal that he feels, a real, utter to the core sense of betrayal. And he comes to his mother, so, well, this Eric Ulot has been raising me all his life, this German war vet who came into the house and from prison camp and married you, is not my father. Who's my father? And the answer is doubly shocking. Well, it's not a German war vet. It was an American war vet. The way she put it, basically, it was like basically a one-night stand. Troops are passing through. It's a crazy time. It's war. Everybody is disoriented and uprooted, and things happen. And when he asks, where is he? And she says, I don't know. I have no idea. That was the answer for about 50 years, 50 long years.
Wow. Yeah.
And it only changed after his very, 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 very old grandmother passed away, and he finds this shoebox with pictures of this American soldier and his mother over a period of time as a family with him there raising him. And that this, then that's the second massive shock. Well, it wasn't a one-night stand. This went on for several years. And then he discovers all these amazing love letters that he sent in that box that he sent to Gertrude, saying, you know, to come to the United States, because he was sent back and all that, and bring the boy who he loved very much. And another shock. And the third shock being that Gertrude never got the letters. The mom intercepted the letters, and amazingly, instead of just destroying them, you're going to intercept the letters, actually kept them. And this sets Jürgen off on an incredible search to try to find his father, where he lived, who he was, and we follow him on that incredible search, which does profoundly change his life.
And it takes years, really. For I mean, you guys follow him for a couple, I guess, but it's been years. I mean, his line too was, you know, and I wonder to what degree, you know, in a sense, we all are in a way waiting, you know. But he says, "I'm still waiting for some answers," you know, and that his commitment to this, you know, to find out what to put a period on it, right? Find the resolve, come to some sort of conclusion that says I'm now okay with this, at least, you know.
Well, you want to know something. I think all of us, in whatever searches we take, we all want to put that final period, but after all, we never really do put a final period,
right?
And I think in Jürgen's search and in Malka's search, they get a lot closer to it. They get a lot closer. And what I think we can say, without giving away too much of the story, is that I think that while they harbor some very deep mixed feelings about why their parents kept the secret so long, both Malka and Jürgen, I think they go a long way. If I was to put it in percentage terms, I'd say 85% to 90% of at least understanding why they did it.
Right.
Maybe they wouldn't
right.
agree with all of it, but why they did it, which is a big, big deal, because both of them have bonded with me in some way, because they both felt a tremendous sense of closure, at least. It's not a final period, but closure of a sense.
Martin, after spending so many years, you know, as a correspondent, as a documentarian and a journalist, and digging into some pretty complicated, difficult stories, I mean, would you say we are so much more, I don't want to go too corny or too idealistic, but, you know, we're kind of all in this together. I mean, I was so struck by how, as the story unfolds, people reaching out. Some people didn't want to talk to you guys at all. And I think I get that on one hand. I don't want to go back to my past. I don't want to go back to those memories. But the overarching sense for me was there was this group of people who actually, you know, really cared. And who really wanted to make a difference in people's lives, and, you know, way back to World War II and kind of all the way through up to present day. Would you say that that's kind of the world we live in, or are you a hopeful cynic? there's a couple questions in there.
well, put it this way. I think that by using the story as a receptacle, I've covered a lot of conflict in my mm-hmm. career as a journalist. Mm-hmm. I've covered wars in the West Bank, in Israel, in Gaza, in Iraq, in Lebanon, and in the Balkans. I've seen an awful lot of conflict and a lot of brutality.
But
in amid all that brutality, there are definitely many sparkles of incredible kindness, caring, and people taking enormous risks to help people. Mm-hmm. There is a pervasive sense of humanity among all that brutality that's somewhere intrinsic among us. And it comes in the most simplest, unexpected forms, whether it's somebody taking a risk and helping someone or shielding someone or just caring for a person who lost something. And I think that that's the bright spot in a lot of the brutality that we see. I mean, you know, Jürgen and Malka could not come from more diametrically opposite.
Yes.
Sides on a very brutal war, probably one of the most brutal we've ever seen, if not the most brutal. Yet when they go through their searches, we see they're basically human beings.
Yes.
And we see that they actually react in many similar ways. And fundamentally, that's what we are. Sure, there's a sea of brutality, but there are lots of nice kernels of kindness all the way through.
Watching a film like this, watching these stories kind of come together and interconnect in their own kind of unique and interesting ways, it has to, I think, as a viewer, you have to ask, you know, how would I behave in that situation, first of all? But how, you know, how, I'm a parent, I've got a 9 and 11-year-old, what am I holding back? Right? What is it? You know, I know in my own life, with my family, there's all kinds of secrets that we still haven't been told, and probably will, in a sense, never be told. And you know, the more since seeing the film, I've reflected on that. I wonder to what degree that has, I don't know, chiseled away at my own identity. My identity is different than it would be, I guess, had I been told those stories. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think all of us as parents, you know, you have young children, so all of us as parents want to protect our children. we want to shield them from what we know as adults as a very complicated, not good and bad world, but a multicolored world full of all sorts of moral dilemmas and tough choices that we make that could be judged in different ways. And maybe good choices or bad, we've all made good and bad choices, all of us as human beings. And as parents, we want to show a more reasonable world, a kinder world, so that our children can grow up and learn for themselves their own complexities. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we shield all sorts of secrets and dilemmas that we have as adults because our children don't have the defenses or we naturally want to protect them. I think we can all agree on that. But now magnify that 10,000 times. I mean, you have small children. Now imagine you and your wife are in hiding, and if you're exposed, mm-hmm. you'll be killed.
Yep.
And your wife gives birth to a child, your first child, and you know that that child's got to be out of wherever you are in one day, or both of you and a lot of other people are going to die. And you're making a very tough choice because you know you're threatening the life of that child, a one-day-old child in the middle of the winter. You're threatening that life of that child. And everything in your instinct is telling you, you have to protect that child. And yet, you have to protect the people that are here. And you made that child. So you can imagine the deep moral dilemma and the trauma of the decision you made that I'm sure will go for the rest of your life. And then you take and you then hide that from the next child that you have, make sure they don't go through that.
With the work that you've done as a war correspondent and the difficult situations that you be in, do you think historically we need to look back and maybe I don't know, cut some folks some slack? You know, you're in the middle. It's all really about freedom, choice, and responsibility. It seems to me, but like you said, when you're in the middle of a situation like that, what then? You know, what are the decisions you're going to make? And so it's easy to look back and go, oh, I'd behave this way, right? But you must have something to say about that.
Yeah, well, I think there are levels where that comes into play. There are different levels. For example, I'll tell you, when I was a war corps, I can't even say this is a break. It's not a break. It's just a quirk of events. When I was very young and I was working as a field producer I was in the Middle East and I was working with a veteran television correspondent by the name of Clark Todd, who was CTV's London correspondent and was in Lebanon. In those days, you worked on tapes and those tapes had to get somewhere to be satellited. It's not internet. It's not that type of thing. It was a long time ago. And I was responsible. I was told, you stay put at this base and you get the tapes. And then you put it in satellite out where, of course, I'm young and dumb and everything else. And no, I want to be in the front lines where this correspondent is and working out there. But I did my job. And then one day the tapes stopped coming and I didn't know what was going on. And then I get a call from the president, vice president of CTV News at the time, and saying that Clark Todd has disappeared and that he's probably been wounded in Lebanon. And we have to find him. And you know something about there. So we all have to go and find him. And for the next several days, all three of us, more than several days, about a week, went through amazingly harrowing experience of searching field hospitals, bodies, battlefields, getting bombed at, shot at, etc., to try to get to where this guy was. And it took about a week or so, and then we found him not living, and we knew that there was a crew with him. And it led to a very serious dilemma, you know, why did the crew go and he's there? But you know, immediately then, and especially now, there's no way I could say I would do any different because I was not there. I could never, ever answer that question. They can never answer the question maybe too, because things are made in split-second decisions. You can't answer that. You can't judge it. You can't possibly put yourself into that situation because every human being will react differently. And there's no right or wrong in that situation.
So the only
sad thing is this man lost his life.
Yeah.
And
it's talk about relevant. And just in the last, what is it, two days ago, the two bodies of the UN researchers found in the DR Congo. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, but it's just been all over the news in the last couple of days. And you gotta. I mean, I've got so many questions for you, you know, based on that. But you know, what drives you to do the work that you do in the first place? But is and I want to come back to that in a second if we can. But I wonder, Is there a way, Martin, to prepare for that kind of thing? You know, you get thrown into a war-like situation? How pray tell, do you come to that with any kind of wisdom, you know, to begin with?
Every human being reacts differently to stressful situations of all sorts. It doesn't have to be a war. It could be a car accident. It could be just a crisis, an emotional crisis. It could be a lot. Every human being reacts differently. If anything this has told me is, you can get the toughest person or the weakest person, somebody you think will crack immediately and somebody that wouldn't, and you have no idea how a person will react in any given situation. It's just, it's unpredictable. The only thing you can prepare for is by gaining experience in a controlled manner in those situations with limited responsibility, and to acquire some basic medical knowledge that if somebody, God forbid, does get hurt, you know how to at least deal with the very basics. That's about all that you can do, and the rest is just sheer experience. And for me, that experience, I was only 26 years old, taught me an extremely important lesson that many journalists unfortunately fall victim to, and as we have an illusion of vulnerability. We think when we're in a conflict zone, because we are not a fighter, we're not a combatant, we're not holding weapons, that we have an illusion of vulnerability, as if all the sides are going to respect that, which is a total illusion.
Right.
And that's how many, many correspondents and others get killed, hurt, etc., because there is no illusion of vulnerability. There is no such respect. It's basically you have to be extremely careful in how you do things. And I learned very, very fast at the beginning of my career that things can go terribly wrong. And that's a healthy respect of fear that keeps you going in the right direction.
So if you weren't a war correspondent, if you weren't a journalist in the sense, in the way that you have been, as you look back on your career, do you think you would have been a detective, a mystery novelist?
I have absolutely no idea. You know, it's again one of those, life doesn't just, you know, life works in a certain way. I didn't plan a lot of this, you know.
Yeah, no, it's true, eh? It's so interesting how things play out. But there must be something about getting to the kernel, getting to the truth, getting to the bottom of it that is so, that's the fire in your belly, if you will.
Well, the investigative journalism is a compulsion. It's a form of a compulsion, and it's sort of like an obsessive compulsive disorder. you have to be obsessed with something, but not to the point of an emotional disturbance, or you'll never get anywhere.
Right, right.
But you've got to be a bit obsessive compulsive to have the drive and the force to actually keep going to get to whatever it is you're going. Because a lot of this doesn't involve just working. It involves, like, you've got to be thinking about it a lot and constantly going over it and then seeing this opportunity and driving for it. And so without that, you're not, you can't really do it because it's just a little bit too crazy.
Is it the truth that drives you?
I wouldn't put it like, I don't believe in absolute truth.
Okay.
I don't believe there is one real truth. I think there's relative truth, but I think it's to get to the bottom of whatever you're going for. Like let's stick with this film.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Which,
by the way, is airing on April the 9th for our listeners on the documentary channel.
At 9 p.m. Eastern.
9 p.m. Eastern, and I think it's going to be repeated a couple of weeks later, and I'm going to get to the bottom of that, too, before our interview ends.
I believe it's on the 26th.
There you go. You've already done it. Yeah. Thanks.
Sure. Basically, when I understood, I spend a lot of time, people, when they tell their stories, are very emotional about it, and they're very disoriented, and they tell things in mumbo-jumbo. They leave out a tremendous amount of facts, and what they leave out is sometimes extremely interesting.
Right.
And then you discover it afterwards, and it's not done consciously. It's all done unconsciously. So with Malka, I spent a lot of time trying to understand the story and to really understand what was going on and who knew what. And there was many, many facts that didn't make any sense. But when I did get to the kernel that there's a sister out there that maybe is alive and maybe not, and there's a whole story behind this sister, I had to absolutely know what happened to the sister. I had to, and knowing full well the odds are really stacked against me. There are too many people who have died, and too many, you know, too many survivors have died, too many witnesses have died, too many other people have gone. And I just, you know, I said, okay, well, you know, it's, we're already on this search. If we don't find out, well, then we don't find out. We'll just go with it where we can go and see. It's a story in itself. I mean, I'm amazed that we did find what really, what's the truth there. And that's something that's very unusual, because I didn't really expect to, but I was very much compelled to try to find out. And by the way, the people we took on in Poland to try to find out were also irresistibly compelled.
Of course, I don't know how you could be otherwise once you were drawn into sort of the circle of the story.
Right.
It must be quite an interesting experience as a filmmaker, documentarian, to writer, you know, whatever, journalist, to go into something like this with such a huge commitment, not knowing, you know, how it's going to play out. What actually is the story? Like, we have an idea. You sort of write a documentary, I suppose, to some degree. You can't really storyboard it, that's for sure. And then you go into it with all this commitment and, you know, I would imagine financial investment and time and passion, and then, you know, we don't know where we're actually going to land. What a huge risk.
It's huge and it's not huge, because what I was saying is the actual search began to be very, very interesting.
Mm.
And I said to myself, you know, as a documentary, you know, I'm getting a story anyway. If I don't get to the bottom of it, you know, it is going to be affecting Malka's life. There is something there. I don't know what the end is going to be, but I was already on to it, you know. And so, I mean, like, along the way, you know, when we started to retrace, and we were filming, you know, we were retracing people who lived in forests, hiding in the most impossible conditions, you know, Jews that were hiding in these forests, which is an integral part of this story, and in the most impossible conditions, where I bet you and I and others in a Polish winter, which is as fierce as any Canadian winter, without jackets, clothes, food,
it's just sort of
hiding in underground pits to somehow, and hugging each other to stay warm. I don't know how long you and I would survive.
Yeah.
You know, and another example, there was another person, a Toronto person that we were searching their story too. A fellow named Morris Sternberg, we were searching his story. And actually, I think we came to a conclusion on his story, but he didn't accept it, and so therefore I didn't go to a certain point with it in the film, and I just stopped after a while. But Morris Sternberg, his parents hid him in a pit in a barn for 2 years, for a year, in a Polish farm with manure on top of it, and he was between 2 and 4 years old. Now, you imagine having your 2 or 3 year old kid in a barn in a pit with manure on top of it in the middle of a farm, freezing in the winter, and knowing that if you come out of it, you're going to die. You really wonder. So, in essence, when I filmed these places, I said, well, here's a story in itself. If I don't get to the bottom of it, I'm getting, you know. And then we spoke to survivors, people who lived in this forest, and you know, of 1,000 Jews who hid in this forest, only 40 survived, and we spoke to one of the 40.
Yeah, no,
actually, two of the 40.
It's got to feel like a real privilege to be able to sort of shine the light into some of these people's lives and these stories and peel back the layers.
And when you go to the forest and you see it, then it all comes alive, and that in itself is the search. So I said to myself, well, if I'm not going to get to the bottom of it, I'm at least going to get the searches. Incredible.
Martin, I hate to do this, but we're going to have to wrap up in a couple of minutes, but I do want to definitely talk about something that really struck me. So, you know, I'm always fascinated by films, you know, especially documentaries that sort of suggest that this is what they're about, and yet they end up being about so much more nuanced and rich and, you know, interconnected. You know, I mean, there's a complexity to your film and to the story, and I mean, this is about isolation and family and truth and the past and memories and love and identity, right? And helping others, reaching out. And I mean, it's crazy to me, all the layers on what appears to be, you know, as I think the blurb on CBC's website talks about an engrossing mystery, right? This is, you know, but it's so much more than that. And one of the things that really struck me, and it is absolutely palpable in your film, is this sense of family, this sense of finding my way back home. And I've talked about that before with other documentarians over the years. I got a little bit of a shiver there as I mentioned it to you, but it really comes through in Jürgen's story, I think, and how, you know, he said he just really wanted, I guess he really desperately wanted and needed to meet his real dad and essentially hug him at one point, I think he says in the film, right? That's what I really missed. And so I was just struck with the sense of, yeah, finding our way back home. We're all a little disconnected. We're all kind of out there looking for a community, looking for friendships, looking for our parents. Whatever it is, it's a metaphor for something else, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, well, Jürgen always, and it's interesting, he says that Jürgen always felt somewhat out of place in his family.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't look like his father.
Right.
Not even very much like his mother, but the real father, and we see the photos
sure.
and start the search, an amazing resemblance.
Yes.
An astounding resemblance. He is really looking for a sense of belonging. And in his emotional mind, he felt, rightly or wrongly, and it's not important if it's right or wrong, that somehow by finding that father and finding his life, he will find the emotional home that he sort of feels he never really had. And it's really striking what he does find. And could that really be his emotional home?
Right.
But it's not important. What's really important is that's the driving force in his life for many, many years. Otherwise, he wouldn't search for so many years to find him. We all sort of look for that place where we belong.
That's yeah. Well, I think, you know, for me, I mean, there's so many things to talk about, so many sort of lessons coming out of a story like this. It's interesting. It's entertaining. It really is an engrossing mystery story. I mean, it's absolutely. But I think there's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. And I love this idea of inclusion over exclusion. I think for me, that's one of the bigger messages of your film, is that we all do need to either be embraced or to embrace, if that makes sense, as a parent, as a friend, as a teacher, as a priest, as a politician.
Well, I would buy that interpretation.
I think it's beautiful, and thank you for congratulations, and thanks for
thank you.
Thanks for an interesting As I think somebody said in one of the pieces I read, has all the, quote, ingredients of a classic, close quote. Martin Himmel here with us today talking about Secrets of Survival. It is going to be world premiering on the Documentary Channel on Sunday, April 9th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 Pacific. And it's going to follow up is when, Martin?
April 26th. I don't have the exact time, but April 26th.
Yeah, so check it out online. You can find it on CBC's documentary site. And also check out Martin-Himmel.com online as well. Martin, thanks so much for your time. Direct from Tel Aviv, man. It sounds like you were around the corner, and I always still marvel at that. It's been
well, here we are.
Wonderful conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.